And fearful for the state of the country?
Looking for ways to fight back, or all of the above? Well, we want you to know that there are plenty of ways to resist.
Join the resistance with WBAI. Find out what's happening on WBAI's actions and event calendar at WBAI.org.
Again, for a list of upcoming actions and demonstrations, visit WBAI.org/calendar.php.
You are listening to radio station WBAI, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the web. You cannot buy the revolution. You cannot make the revolution. You can only be the revolution. It is in your spirit, or it is nowhere. From The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. Time is just about 8 p.m. on a Wednesday evening, which means it's time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. On Billy Bomb for the best, expect the worst.
And a very good evening to you. The program is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you, and I'm joined in the studio by Alex.
Good evening.
And by Voltaire.
Good evening.
So, all kinds of things are going on. Alex, you're looking a little jet-lagged. What's up?
Well, thank you. Thanks for that. I appreciate it. I am, in fact, a little bit jet-lagged. I think everybody's been doing a little bit of traveling these days. I know Emmanuel and Kyle are still on their own adventure somewhere. And yesterday I got back from Dubai for a business trip, which was quite interesting. Have you ever been, Voltaire?
No, they're telling me about it.
It was quite an interesting trip. It was a city to which I'd never been either. And it was such a long flight back that I went through London, landed at JFK, was so exhausted because my flight left at 2:25 in the morning from Dubai, that I got here and immediately called my wife and said, you know, I'm so tired. I think I'm not going to go to the office. I'm just going to go home, but I don't know what I'm going to do. I have to do the radio show tonight. I really had no idea that yesterday was Tuesday until she reminded me that the radio show was Wednesday and that was today, which yesterday was tomorrow. So I am a bit out of sorts, so I apologize if my comments are even more incoherent than they usually are. But Dubai's a very interesting city, and I have to say, I didn't dislike it as much as I thought I was going to. You know, everything you hear about Dubai is that it's sort of pre-planned. It's you know, it's sort of like, you know, an Arab version of Reston, Virginia, or something.
Or Vegas, know? Or dry Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. It does have a very much like a Vegas feel to it, because there is a strip. There's kind of a gigantic highway running through the city. And you see all these kind of brand new high rises popping up everywhere. There's construction. It seems quite literally at every single corner. But these buildings are gigantic, and they just seem to be cropping up everywhere and really, really quickly. I mean, if you think about New York, we've been trying to get the Second Avenue subway finished since World War II. You know, with the rate they do things in Dubai and the UAE, you know, they'd have that done in like 3 months.
But that's, the subway is below ground. They're building stuff above ground.
That's true.
That's much easier. We have stuff being built above ground everywhere, too.
Yeah. Well, I'm just talking about the, kind of the general speed at which things move over there. It's really, really fast. And, of course, they have the tallest building on the planet at the moment, the Burj Khalifa, which just kind of towers over everything in the city. But there are so many high-rises that it's actually hard to see the tallest building on Earth unless you're, you know, standing at the right vantage point. And when you're at the top of the Burj Khalifa, I mean, you realize really how tall that thing is. I mean, it is gigantic.
Did you go to the top?
I did go to the top. I had a couple of hours to spare.
Did you walk?
No, we did not.
That's one of my, like, half the reason I want to go, just to say I've walked up it.
You'll be walking for a really, really long time.
I could do it.
The elevator, though, it only takes about a minute
to
get to the top. I mean, your ears are popping. It's going really, really quickly. You only have to make one change as well. I think on the 125th floor, you make one quick change, and then you go up to the 148th floor. And then, I mean, you can see basically forever.
Wow.
It would be really neat to be up there and watch one of these dust storms roll in, which would be kind of neat. But the other thing that's odd about Dubai is that it you have all these buildings popping up and they're everywhere. So the skyline of it would sort of look a lot like New York because you have all these gigantic buildings. But unlike New York, the buildings aren't right on top of each other. There's a lot of space at the bottoms, and every building sort of has its own kind of gallery of shops and whatnot at the bottom. But there's a lot of space in between the buildings, which, frankly, I think is a bit of a mistake in terms of the planning because it makes it more difficult to walk around. Mm-hmm. You have to have a car. You have to be driven everywhere. There is some public transportation, and you know it seems to be very efficient, but you still have a lot of space in between these buildings. And it makes it a little bit tricky, I think, to really understand the city because these buildings, a lot of them look very similar to each other. You know, there's never anything that's real square. They always have these kind of strange shapes around them. And in any one building, there could be, you know, any number of restaurants, clubs, cigar bars, offices. So to really understand that city, it's hard to get to know, I think. But if you're there with people who are in the know, it actually can be quite a fun place.
Yeah.
You just have to, I think, have the right attitude to explore it properly. The other thing that I thought was quite interesting about it, and to me somewhat annoying, is that oftentimes at the bottoms of these buildings, you have these gigantic squares, and they're kind of pretty, and they're full of grass and whatnot. And Dubai is kind of an expat town. There's lots of expats from all over the place. So in addition to the regular citizens of the UAE, the Emiratis, you have lots and lots of people from all over the place, and everybody seems to be so interested in exercise. You know, they just get tons of people, you know, doing exercise in the early evening hours on these lawns.
Isn't it unbearably hot, though?
It wasn't when we were there. It was about 75 degrees.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Perfect. But, you know, in July and August, I hear quite literally it's like opening an oven door when you go outside. But, you know, there's so many people exercising, and I find it just, you know, really annoying. One of the things I hate most about New York is joggers. And to see all these people just exercising as if the world is their own gym just kind of, you know, annoys me. You know, go inside and work out. I don't need to see this. You know, people doing push-ups and chin-ups and, you know, public squares and things like that. It's very distracting. I just want to walk around and think and not be distracted by, you know, people doing pull-ups around.
It sounds a lot less distracting than cars.
Possibly, yeah, quite possibly. But it is a very interesting city in a lot of respects, and definitely someplace I think would be, you know, worthwhile to visit. Technologically, it's very, very cool and has a lot to offer. And I think that we may have our usual hosts on the line, too.
We do. I've been doing some finagling over here, and I've pushed a big button that says Emmanuel and Kyle, which should have made them happen. Emmanuel and Kyle, are you with us?
Yeah, we're here. This is just so typical of the things that happen when you're trying to communicate with people. Even even people who host a communications radio show have trouble making connections. And you were calling me, and my phone was only ringing once and then immediately hanging up. And then I tried returning your call, but the plus one wasn't carried, and I was getting something strange in this country. And then you texted me the phone number, and it was the wrong phone number.
Yeah.
So, yeah, half the show is over now.
Well, we
finally made contact.
We were saying a lot about you guys, but we figured we'd give you the honest chance to rebut. But no, what we've said about you so far is that you guys are traveling, and you are now in Iceland, I believe. Is that so?
That is correct. We are. Kyle's here as well.
Hey guys, what's up? Feels like I haven't talked to you in a while.
Well, you haven't. What's going on?
I think the last time we talked to you, we were in Bucharest, Romania. And since then, we've been to the country of Moldova, which I challenge any listener to write to OTH at 2600.com who has been to Moldova and tell us what you thought of that country. We thought it was amazing. It was just a very different type of a place, a country that really, I think, is coming into its own and is modernizing in ways that maybe you wouldn't expect. And we've seen that as kind of a theme in the places that we've been to. After Moldova, we made our way up through Ukraine. And actually, we almost got stuck in Ukraine because we couldn't get a train the route that we wanted to go to get to Berlin, which was our stepping point to get to London. So we had to basically use our hacker skills to route around the problem being train agents in Kiev who wouldn't help us. So we had to go to a city called Lviv in the southwestern part of Ukraine, and from there get a local train across the border into Poland, and then from there go over to Wrocław in Poland, and then shoot up to Berlin. At every step, we were met with people in train stations saying it was impossible to get a train, at least on the day we wanted to get a train. But with persistence and the handy train book that I have, I was able to make it happen. And through our persistence, we finally were able to make it to Iceland.
Was Lviv a separatist part of Ukraine?
No, it was pretty much part of Ukraine.
You know, I guess the other option is you probably could have taken a flight, but that would have just been against ideology.
That's cheating.
No, we did, though, in many cases, understand the system better than they did. And like he said, it was mostly about listening, communicating with gestures. Obviously, you know, there's huge language barriers. But the point is we got through it. And, yeah, it's like we would just route around things, kind of like any network, basically finding our way, using the book that we had as a kind of a foundational reference. But it's more fun to use the terrestrial stuff, and we ended up seeing like all these really cool high speed trains in places like Ukraine and Poland, which really you wouldn't know about otherwise.
Yeah, there are rules to this. No buses and no airplanes. You have to stick to trains, and it's not hard to stick to trains in Europe because they're everywhere. You can get to almost any town in almost any country. And what I was amazed by was how much trains have improved in Ukraine and in Poland. It's almost on a Western European par right now. And it's just, it makes me really upset at how advanced they're getting and how we're not advancing at all, because we're not putting anything into our infrastructure. We're not seeing these improvements. It really does make a huge difference. Train agents aside, it's almost like, you know, we're dealing with two different worlds, the world of the train agent, which, you know, goes back into, it seems, the 1930s, long lines, you know, hot rooms, angry people, and then the efficient, fast train service that actually exists now.
So while you're in Iceland, I know this is something you were shooting for, and I'm wondering if you've managed to achieve it. Have you seen any northern lights?
No, damn it, we have not seen northern lights. We have this app that occasionally wakes us up in the middle of the night and says northern lights might be visible, but so far hasn't happened. And you know, it's starting to lose patience for these things. You know, been around the entire country. We drove the ring road, which is Route 1, goes all around Iceland, and we did that in the winter. Very lucky that we did it when we did, because had we tried it now, I understand some roads are closed, and we hit some really dramatic weather.
So you were in the northernmost part of Iceland?
Sorry, say again?
You made it to the northernmost part of Iceland?
Not the northernmost part, but the northernmost part that that road goes to.
Yeah, we're in the capital of the north, a town called Akureyri. It's actually a college town, and really kind of cool, second largest city, I believe, municipality in Iceland. So we did. We went to a lot of the major cities to stop off as we were driving so that, so we could rest and be ready for the road the next day. A lot of inclement weather, a lot of, like blinding snow. You can imagine, you know, large trucks passing you and you getting like, these blasts of snow that you just completely, you know, in complete whiteout, completely invisible ahead of you for a second. That kind of like, you know, heart-stopping moment is basically what we had for a good part of it, and a little bit more rain when we got further east and south.
Well, Iceland is not as cold as you might think it is. It's actually rather temperate. It gets cold in some parts, the northern parts, but the southern parts, yeah, you actually see rain this time of year. But it's also very slippery, very frozen in many parts, and the weather changes very quickly, too. You know, you'll see a foot of snow in one place, and then just sleet and ice, and then a dry road all within a day.
And incredibly high winds. And we had to actually learn some new conversions. The wind is actually measured in meters per second out here, which that might actually be something that's normal in many parts of the world. But for us, we had to figure that out fairly quickly. You basically double it, and it's miles per hour. But it was interesting.
It turns out 10 meters per second is something you should start being concerned about. Anything below that is not a big deal.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because when I went to Iceland, I guess it was maybe about 2003 or so, I was living in Vermont, which incidentally is someplace where I actually did see the Northern Lights several times on account of a solar flare. So maybe if there's a solar flare imminent, you might be able to catch the Northern Lights while you're over in Iceland anyhow. But having gone from Vermont to Iceland, also in the winter, right about this time, I found Iceland to be so much warmer than Vermont. It was kind of incredible. Another neat thing that I thought about Iceland, which is, you know, the people are so incredibly nice and so incredibly welcoming, and it didn't really square with me why in the kind of the pubs and bars in the evening, why there were so many bouncers. I found there to be, you know, lots of security. And then I had realized when I was traveling with a buddy of mine that we think that the bouncers were so numerous because they were just there to make sure that these Icelandic people themselves didn't hurt themselves, in that, you know, they weren't afraid of anybody starting a fight or, you know, gang violence or something like that. It was just they knew that they were going to drink too much and needed to be escorted out properly. And that was, you know, one thing that I thought was, you know, quite a stark contrast from New York and Iceland, was the kind of the general attitude of the people, the attitude of the security personnel in particular at all these various places. I'm not sure if you've run into that kind of component of Iceland just yet.
Not as much this time of year, sort of the off season. I do know what you mean. There were a lot of people at the door the last time we were here in June. Of course, you have cruise ships and a lot of people, and anytime you get masses of people, you're going to have you know, bad actors and people like overdoing it. But I can definitely tell you, like, just from what I learned on this trip, there's a very low incidence of, I think, crime and definitely violence. That violent crime, that kind of stuff, is not nearly what we might, you know, be accustomed to back in the States or in other parts of the world. And, you know, Iceland in general is just kind of a peaceful place from what I've experienced, and the people are quite affable and welcoming.
And you know, they have an impression of us, which it kind of parallels what Kyle's saying here, where, you know, if you say you're from New York or from America, they kind of just are really curious, like, what in God's name is going on over there? And, you know, we were in a small town up north, We just stopped for coffee in the middle of our drive. And very pleasant place, very small. And we just happened to mention we were from the United States. And this woman just, without any prompting whatsoever, said that she refused to go to our country until we get rid of our president. I just thought that was so incredible that in the middle of literally nowhere in Iceland, that is the prevailing sentiment among the people.
Well, you know, we here also would like to know what the hell is going on over here, but we're doing our best to figure it out.
Yeah, I don't blame her for that sentiment at all. I can completely understand it. And what do you guys think about the water? I mean, everything is heated with this geothermal energy, and then the hot water has this very sulfuric type of smell, and the cold water comes directly from the glaciers, right? I mean, what's your experience with the water over there?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of, like, things that people... You have to kind of understand about it. First of all, the sulfur smell, as far as like tap water, is mainly on the hot side. So anything that's like warmer from the tap is possibly going to have that kind of odor. But if you run it for about 10 seconds or 10 minutes on the cold side, you really don't have any of that. And it's really... quite good water. As you said, often Icelandic people are quite proud of their water and the fact that it comes from glacial flow and other sorts of sources to the ground wells or wherever it's extracted. And that mostly predates the Industrial Revolution and other factors that have contaminated a lot of our sources, and also I don't think it's processed quite in the same way. We use a lot of chemicals, especially in urban places like New York City, and well, you get the idea. So yeah, to that end, it's pretty cool to drink. I was just researching that, so it's really funny you asked that. As far as the geothermal and just how it's used, so you are right, it's the geothermal activity is used by this power company called ON, and they have basically supplied all the power. There's also, I believe, hydroelectric facilities and other sources. And a lot of smaller people, like you imagine like a farmer or somebody who basically might survey their land, realize they have sort of a formation that is warm, and they can basically produce their own steam and thus have maybe a small generator. So you will notice that these basically smaller versions of exactly that very large system that supplies cities like Reykjavik. And there's other really innovative ways. We stayed in one place that basically had no radiators, no heat vents, no nothing. And we surmised that based on what they told us of the shower, it was heated from natural sources. We basically realized they probably also heat the entire building through in-floor heating, which is basically like coils of tubing that is placed in the floor before it's finished. And that radiates heat from the floor. And actually, they had a part of town last time that was under construction that they were doing the exact same thing. And we walked back through that part of town this time just to see that there was no ice or anything on it, because, indeed, a pedestrian walkway outside was heated in this way.
I mean, it really is incredible, because they're able to generate so much energy from the earth and harness it in such innovative ways that... It makes life so much easier over there, even when it's not nearly as cold as it is in some parts of the United States. And to go back to the water, have you guys had the chance to try the Viking beer yet, which is brewed with this glacial water? And I found it really kind of amazing. And when I was there, the exchange rate certainly did not favor Americans. In Iceland, everything was extraordinarily expensive. So I know that the currency has fallen quite a bit.
That's an interesting thing, because on this trip, I mentioned... We're in Moldova, where things are incredibly cheap. You can, eat like a king and pay maybe $10. And here, if you get a slice of pizza, expect to pay $20 for that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It's terrible.
Things are incredibly expensive. But, you know, if you're here in the wintertime like we are, it only becomes an outrageous ripoff rather than something unfathomable like it does in the summertime where you can pay, you know, $500 for a hotel room. It's insane. But, you know, there are ways around that. You stay in hostels. For some reason, renting a car is extremely cheap compared to other things. So there's that. You can figure out places to stay that, and food you can eat. For instance, they have these amazing hot dogs in Reykjavik that I don't know what the story is behind them. But every time we come here, we're just drawn to them. They're only $4.50, which I know is expensive for a hot dog, but you know it fills you up. It's really good. They sell them in the street until really late at night, and that's another thing. This city is a very late night city, so there's people up pretty much all night. So it's really cool. And you know what else? We have listeners in Iceland. In fact, we met one. We met Johan a couple of times, actually. He was kind enough to bring me something that I really wanted, and I'm bringing this back to the States. It's an Icelandic phone book. Now, You know what's interesting about an Icelandic phone book? I don't know. Are you guys familiar with the naming convention in Iceland?
Yes, with all the various suns.
Yes, I'll use you as an example, Alex.
Oh, great.
Let's say you had a son named Bob, Bob's name would actually be Bob Alexson, because Bob is your son and your name is Alex.
It makes perfect sense.
So, mm-hmm. Yes. Now, Bob's sister Alice would be, hang on, do I have this right? Would be named Alice's daughter? Is that how it works?
I think that's right.
No, I'm confused already.
I think it's like a D-O-T-T-I-R daughter.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they make things very, very efficient, very fathomable, and I'm very interested for you to bring back this Icelandic phone book because when I was there in 2003, I was not able to verify this, but at the time, I had heard that in this country of only 300,000 or so people, and I imagine it's probably still the same population, that you could actually look up, and I don't know if this was a rumor or not, but that you could actually look up the phone number in the phone book of the Prime Minister.
Of course. That's kind of cool. In fact, we were walking around Parliament the other night, and it was pretty much unguarded. It was just, you know, another building. You could walk right up to it, it's open to the public, as it should be. But just to get back to the phone book for a second, the thing that's really interesting about this is that everybody is listed by first name. So right now I'm coming through it. There are 10 pages of Annas, right? So there's basically you know their first name, and you just have to know their last name, but they're all listed alphabetically by first name. We looked up Kyle, and there's only one Kyle in Reykjavik, but there's 10 pages of Annas.
Do you have the phone book with you now?
Yeah, I do. You want to look something up?
Yeah, let's try probably the Prime Minister.
Well, first of all, I'm not going to call the Prime Minister at, 1:20 in the morning? And second of all, I don't know the Prime Minister's name offhand. And third, if they're not in Reykjavik, they're in a different section of the book, and there's a lot of thumbing through pages that I'm not prepared to do right now. But I do have the book. In fact, I've got two of them. We found another one. This was awesome. We were driving through this small city or town, and we just saw this bookstore. We stopped in the bookstore, and it was a coffee shop, and they sold vinyl records. It was everything that was cool. We just had this long conversation with the guy who ran it, and it was actually in the same town that Bobby Fischer, the racist chess master, moved to, and where he's buried as well. So we stopped just out of curiosity, saw this bookstore, and went to get coffee and talked to a guy about vinyl records, and he happened to have a phone book too, and we bought it from him.
So were they selling phone books in the bookstore, or did you just buy this person's individual phone book off of him?
Well, no, you know, it turns out he actually kind of grabbed a bunch of them when they were, apparently there was a male model who appeared on the cover in 2011, and there was some kind of a scandal involving him, so they pulled all the phone books out, and this bookstore owner saw an opportunity, and basically just collected a bunch of them, And then, you know, I walked into the store and asked for that very phone book, or not that particular one, but a phone book, and he was very happy that somebody actually was requesting something like that. So, yeah, he made out quite well.
But why male models? Anyway,
you know, it's funny. So, phone books, are they actually still used? Do people actually use them? Because this would be a huge contrast from places like New York, where it just mystifies me, you know, why phone books are still being delivered. Because, you know, you just see them pile up in front of buildings and kind of in vestibules of apartment complexes because nobody wants them. They're constantly printed. It's like a full-fledged assault on the world's forest to print these telephone books.
Okay, you know, you can say that, but
I can. I did say it. Yes.
The people who are, you know, letting them pile up outside, they don't deserve phone books. They shouldn't have them. But there are people who still want them, and they are a good complement to you know, to other services that we might have. Now, in Iceland, they did stop printing the phone book in 2013. So yeah, that also makes them a little bit more rare.
One of the things with this is, though, the phone book itself is quite big. It covers the whole country, whereas a phone book the same size would maybe do you know, half of a part of a small section of Manhattan. So the scale is much different. But increasingly, I guess the publisher of this is, you know, further away from the phone company versus it having been sort of in-house and a part of the phone company in the distant past. So the trend has kind of moved away from printing these things, but they're very useful. And
I have a question, though, for you, Alex, regarding phone books, because this is very interesting. How do you look up somebody's phone number these days? If you don't have their phone number and you want their phone number, how do you get it?
It's a very good question. I mean, it's quite difficult, right? I mean, it depends. I mean, are we talking about landlines? Are we talking about, you know, cell phone? It's very, very difficult. Unless you were actually given the phone number or you search
phone number,
for
you
it.
You don't need to get it from information
exactly.
or from the phone book.
That's exactly right. I mean, you generally need to contact a person in order to actually acquire their telephone number these days. I mean, can search for it. You know, you use a search engine to, you know, to find this, you know, put their name in plus what area code you know it is, and generally something will pop up. But, you know, there's no really one centralized place to do this. I mean, I tend to agree with you. You know, phone books serve a purpose, but I feel like in New York they are serving less and less of a purpose, for, you know, for the very reason that Kyle had mentioned, is because New York is just so huge and there's so many people that to have a phone book of every single person's number when, you know, plain old telephone service is going out the window, you know, the utility is dwindling. But in places like Iceland, where the population is very limited, the utility of a phone book seems to be much more relevant.
Well, yeah, that's what I don't understand. You say, you know, a book that has everyone's phone number, you know, a big city like New York, why wouldn't that still be useful? The fact that we don't have cell phone numbers in phone books baffles me. I assume that's still the case. If, you know, we all have phones, and if we wanted our phones to be listed, what a great way for people to be able to contact us, assuming we're still a society that wants people to occasionally contact us.
I think also number portability, I'm not sure how, but I think this factors into it. And also just the fact that people, I guess, in general, don't speak on the phone as much anymore. And also, I mean, that you could argue, I'm sure, but it is a thing. I mean, it just feels like there are a lot less conversations outside of maybe formal settings or conference calls or the sort of business setting. And with regard to business, I would also add, it's very hard to find contact info through websites for businesses. But that is also sort of the last place you'll find phone numbers as well. It's a bit of a paradox, but it's a very strange behavior and I think a loss, this idea of having the ability to contact someone. You really do need their permission to contact them, and even when you do have their number, I mean, how many contacts do you have in your phone, and how many of those do you actually speak with?
Yeah, and businesses also are sort of the last bastion of people needing to call up someone they don't already know. You know, you can call a business and ask, you know, what time they're open or do they do this service or whatever, and that's still accepted as something that people do. Whereas people communicating with their friends, their family, or whoever, that tends to go through other channels nowadays.
Yeah, and I think you hit it right on the head, too, Kyle. I mean, this was, you know, almost a form of etiquette. You know, if you just look somebody's phone number up and then called them without giving them any kind of warning these days, you're sort of like a pariah. I mean, it's almost like you have to text somebody first and then tell them that you're going to call. If you just call somebody and you expect to talk to them and have a conversation, I mean, you don't know what they're doing. They could be in the middle of something. They're definitely not going to answer the phone if they don't recognize your number. You know, we just don't live in a society where I think it's acceptable to use the phone the way that we did 20 years ago. And sure, there's something kind of sad about that.
Certainly. And, you know, just think about that. You know, like you said, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you pick up the phone book, look up somebody's phone number, call them. There was no caller ID. The phone rings. They have no idea who's calling. And you pick up the phone and start a conversation with an unknown person that just found your number in a phone book. Seems so alien and strange to us now, but wow, you know, it makes you realize how quickly things have changed.
Yeah, if you don't get screened into oblivion, and they do talk to you, them knowing you're calling, they may already have an attitude when you pick up, which is fine, you know, if you're good friends and you can take a joke or you know one another, but that sort of neutral answering and I guess politeness of I'll accept this call by talking to someone. You don't have that nicety. It's either, you know, someone you really are on good terms with or, you know, they're already anticipating what you want and thinking, you know, 20 steps and doing all their five-dimensional chess with you.
And God forbid you make a wrong number. You know, you can't do that anymore. You can't call somebody by accident and just say, sorry, wrong number, or just hang up. They'll *69 your ass, and then, you know, say, why did you call me? And then that turns into a whole big thing. It's just not the same as it used to be. The magic has totally gone out of making phone calls.
I really miss wrong numbers. They were always my favorite thing when we grew up with a phone in the house, because I loved all the conversations that I could have with people who had no idea who they were calling. And nowadays, it's very rare. Every so often, I'll get a wrong number text. I was having a fun conversation with somebody earlier today on a wrong number text, but that's a whole other thing. But yeah, there's just that sort of immediacy that just email has not replaced, because you know, you don't get the same sort of subtle joys from email spam.
This doesn't have to be all negative, though. Make a call. Find a reason to talk to somebody. There's definite work to be done on the phone, and it is not gone. And, yeah, we may not have a repository for phone numbers in everybody's phone yet. That sounds like a project for a fifth grader. But, yeah, make a phone call. It's, yeah, it's not impossible. And we all have unlimited everything, I would imagine. And if not, you can top up your prepaid whatever the heck it is, and you know, Vonage or whatever, figure out, you know, whatever scam you're going to use to talk to somebody, and just, you know, actually talk to them.
And I know who you can call. You can call the folks at Off the Hook, because we're going to be leaving you in a second, but they're staying in the studio, and I'm sure they'd love to hear from listeners. Would you not, guys?
We would indeed. So yeah, we'll let you get back to some sort of normal human sleep cycle. But one last question: what's next for you guys on your journey?
Well, we might hit Greenland. We don't know. We're not getting answers to our calls to Greenland, but we're very curious about that place. If you have any listeners there, please write to us, LTH@2600.com. But I think we'll be back in the studio next week. I'm pretty sure about that.
Excellent. Well,
we might double back to the Faroe Islands.
Well, if you when you do get back to the studio, bring one of those phone books, because, you know, all of us would really love to have a look at it. Emmanuel,
yes,
and Kyle.
Late into the night. We can all read through it.
Excellent. You guys have a good night. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye. Good night.
Wow. That's it's always good to catch up with those guys. And Yeah, just so much cool stuff going on.
You never know what you're going to talk about with them. You know, I had no idea we're going to be speaking about phone books at such length and detail this evening. I would have prepared.
Well, I think that was kind of a safe bet, actually, because, you know, we've known these guys for a while.
That's true. It's either trains or phone books or something like that. Yeah, so we had both tonight, actually. So yeah.
There was something you'd mentioned about calling the prime minister, which leads to a news story I wanted to get to tonight, or sort of a news story. The White House, our White House in this here country here in what we live, is they have a comment line set up at 202-456-1111, where you could leave your comments and messages for the president himself. Now, this past weekend, we had a government shutdown, which is always a lot of fun. But this time it was especially interesting because when you called this number, there was nobody there to take your call. But there was also the message that was on the outgoing voicemail was pretty fascinating. We're going to play this for you guys.
Thank you for calling the White House comment line.
Thank you for calling the White House. Unfortunately, we cannot answer your call today because congressional Democrats are holding government funding, including funding for our troops and other national security priorities, hostage to an unrelated immigration debate. Due to this obstruction, the government is shut down. In the meantime, you can leave a comment for the president at www.whitehouse.gov/contact. We look forward to taking your calls as soon as the government reopens.
Now, this fascinates me for so many reasons, and one of them is just the tone of it was amazing. I mean, what do you guys think?
I thought it was just incredible. I mean, really, they managed to convey a sort of condescension and accusations that, you know, you just wouldn't ordinarily get in regular outgoing messages.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so incredible. It's, I think, a new low to turn the outgoing message for a comment line into a partisan political statement about the responsibility for the shutdown of the government. And just completely point the finger at the Democrats, accuse them of sidelining troops and national security. It's really just, you kind of have to laugh at it. It's pitiful.
Yeah, this should go without saying, but it's not even factually accurate. The shutdown did not affect military spending or anything.
Yeah, and what fascinates me, I mean, this actually got some media attention, some news attention, and the recording, which you can't hear anymore because the government is back open now, apparently, and you just get their normal lines and services when you call now. But this recording is archived on the site thisisarecording.com, which is a site that collects all sorts of telephone-related recordings. I highly recommend checking it out. It's a rabbit hole to go down. But now it appears to be, I think, the only copy of this message out there. But yeah, just the sheer, like, sort of petty schoolyard snottiness of it. I mean, I don't think I'm even mad. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And, you know, we should probably give that number out again, which I think you said was 202-456-1111.
Yes, indeed.
Because I'm sure lots of our listeners around the world, and probably including Iceland, maybe that woman in the north as well that Emmanuel and Kyle had run into in a cafe or something, would like to leave the president some comments. 202-456-1111, which is different than, I think, from the switchboard number, which, of course, was 202-456-1414, which was a longtime favorite of phone freaks and hackers in the 90s for prank telephone calls as a switchboard to the White House.
Absolutely.
That was always a lot of fun and also is a number that will work on just about every single store's database for a rewards program. So if you're ever in Duane Reade, CVS, et cetera, I think we've mentioned this before, and you don't have your rewards card or you just don't want them tracking your purchases for everything that you make according to your mobile number, which maybe that's the ultimate goal here. Maybe Duane Reade is going to come up with a universal database of all of our cell phone numbers and then, you know, put that out there in some kind of published packet that's going to be left at our doorsteps in New York, you know, and just become soggy through the rain.
Or maybe Duane Reade will just assume we all work for the White House.
That's possible. It might be true. But that's 202-456-1414. But again, this outgoing message, I think, was really hilarious. It's sort of a new low and pettiness. And I'm surprised that, frankly, they were able to pull it off, given the stories from, you know, a week or so ago about the complete disaster that they had when they were trying to have a conference call, an international conference call where nobody could dial in, people were hearing one side of the conversation. So, you know, you do have to hand it to them. They were able to pull off a condescending, outgoing message in time for the government shutdown. I mean, they didn't obviously bother to schedule meetings to avert the shutdown, but they had the outgoing message planned probably well in advance. I'm sure it took many takes to get that level of condescension and recrimination kind of inherent to every single word that was mentioned.
Absolutely. Moving on, there is a slight update to a story we talked about last week, which is the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency sending out a warning of an incoming missile that, of course, was not actually there, and the fallout from that. A little bit more information came out, this story from the Washington Post, reporting that minutes after the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency mistakenly sent a missile alert at 8:07 a.m. on January 13th, terrifying residents and visitors across the state, some officials rushed to Twitter to reassure everyone it was a mistake, but one Twitter account was deafeningly silent for 17 minutes, that of Hawaii Governor David Ige. And though Ige was informed by the state's adjutant general that the alert was false 2 minutes after it was sent, he waited until 8:24 a.m. to tweet, "There is no missile threat." Now, guys, I'm going to just put this question out there, just knowing how governmental things and bureaucracies work. What do you think was the holdup here?
That's a very good question.
17 minutes seems like a long
17
time.
17 minutes is a long time.
Yeah, leave your constituents thinking that a missile's coming in. So.
Yeah, no question. I mean, perhaps he didn't have a phone book or something. He couldn't get the right intel. I would gather it was something silly.
He was golfing.
Even better, he couldn't log into his Twitter.
Of course.
He didn't know his Twitter password. A quote from him, David Ige, saying, I have to confess that I don't know my Twitter account logons and the password, so certainly that's one of the things that I've made. That's one of the changes that I've made. So, yeah, it's...
Well, look, on the one hand, you know, I think that this is kind of great, because it's reassuring in certain ways to know that a politician of that stature, a governor of Hawaii, is not using Twitter on a regular basis for official communiques of the government. I mean, that, I think, is something to be applauded on the one
hand.
On the other hand, he didn't know his password, which is sort of ridiculous. And thank God he didn't have 2FA set up, two-factor authentication, of course, and had changed his phone, because then he would have had to scan his driver's license, send it over to Twitter, have a letter printed on official letterhead of the governor's office of Hawaii, and then fax that over to Twitter, and then he'd have to make a determination. And then, you know, it might have been several days before he was able to inform the populace that an intercontinental ballistic missile was, in fact, not coming towards them imminently. But it's kind of interesting. Also, on the other hand, this is something that you've talked about quite a bit, Voltaire, which is, you know, again, you know, here's Twitter being used for official government communications. And this was a really obviously important governmental communication.
Yeah, for sure. I actually think that I can take the other view that I think it just because Trump uses Twitter to as a troll, I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that politicians shouldn't use Twitter. I think it's a very effective, low friction way of communicating with the public. Just like FDR made effective use of the radio to communicate his ideas, I think that politicians should be able to use Twitter and do so well.
I agree with that. I think all things in moderation, right? And this 17-minute lag is something to be, I think, examined too. Is it? That's quite a long time, actually. And if you don't know your Twitter password, you know, you click on the "I forgot my password" link, and you reset your password after you realize that their automated message has gone into your spam filter, and then you fish it out, and then you click on the link. That doesn't necessarily take 17 minutes. You know, so what happened here? In all likelihood, I think what happened is that the governor went to reset his password, and then realized that the password was sent probably to an account whose password he didn't have, and then he needed to reset that password, and then get into that account, and then access his Twitter account. That, I think, more accurately accounts for 17 minutes.
We've all been through that loop, I think.
And they're probably all done on very old BlackBerries that they're probably still using.
Yeah, that's probably the case. That's right. So, yeah, 17 minutes on account of this is pretty poor form, but I think I'm going to hold my guns. I like the fact that he's not using Twitter, that he doesn't rely on it all the time. He's obviously not checking it. So, yeah, kudos to him. And I think it does take a certain level of integrity to own up to that. And I think we should applaud him for that. And I think he's probably taken some measures to make sure that that doesn't happen. But at least we got what appears to be most of the story.
Yeah, it's just a shame he didn't have his password written on a post-it, like out in public view, like the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency does. But moving on, I'd like us to take some phone calls if we can. Call us at 347-335-0818.
And tweet at us at Hacker Radio Show.
Absolutely. We'd love to hear from you in the time we've got left in tonight's episode. 347-335-0818. While we're waiting for the light to blink, I'll just read a listener email we've got. A loyal listener writes, that's how they signed it, a loyal listener. Hi guys, in just a few months, my family and I will be heading down to the wonderful world of Disney. We have FastPass, and I know it has RFID. What is the best way to protect it from having any information get sent out, and do you have any notes or suggestions on people who have hacked it? Disney FastPass, you guys have any experience with this sort of action?
I haven't been to Disney since they started using RFID, but you'd probably get invest in a RFID blocking bag or a wallet.
Yeah, that's true, and you can find lots of different variations on that theme on Amazon as well. And sometimes these things go for around $20, but yeah. There's sort of these Faraday tape type bags. You put anything in there. They're good for your cell phones as well, things, your tablets.
Yeah, you get them for passports. I think probably the same kind of technology will work, depending on. But you know, Disney already knows who you are and where you are anyway. Meantime, we've got a phone call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. What's on your mind?
Yeah, about that Hawaii situation. I'm not buying the whole story. I mean, it just doesn't add up. I think that this was some type of test as to the public's reaction in case there is an actual event. I mean, the whole thing is just, it doesn't pass the smell test.
So you think the whole event, the missile warning and everything, was on purpose?
Yeah. Why exactly?
Why would they choose Hawaii? Hawaii is like the most relaxed, chill state. They would like, if any state, you wouldn't be able to accurately judge how a quote unquote regular like neurotic state would react.
And also, it's been said that it is a potential target for North Korea. So, I mean, what better place to stage a real time drill? And does anybody think that the story that somebody pushed the wrong button? Really?
I think that.
Is that how the system works?
They showed pictures of what the interface is. We had a guest last week talking about how poorly designed the interface is. And, frankly, I'm surprised it hasn't happened sooner.
Well, it's an interesting thing to think about. I don't think anyone in the IT InfoSec worlds have all that much doubt that a system can be so badly designed that someone pushes the wrong button and activates a missile alert. But on the other hand, I can't really think of any occasion in which Hawaii has been attacked and that led to some sort of conflict. So,
what about Pearl Harbor?
Oh yeah, there was that, but I can't think of any other one. Anyway, that's a
really?
Point.
And,
I think you were being sarcastic on that. Yes.
Yeah, it's definitely something to think about.
You just dismissed Pearl Harbor out of hand. I mean, your attitude is
no, I did. Yeah, and I'd like to thank everyone here for catching that. But in any case, thank you very much for your call. We'll see what else is going on, and thanks for listening.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I mean, look, and he does have a point. I mean, it is a state that would be under a probable threat. So if you were going to have some kind of test like that,
yeah, no,
you
probably
wouldn't do it in Guam or Hawaii. Guam's not a state. But I don't see why we would need to necessarily measure the reaction of the populace. Everyone, no matter what or where it was, if it was Oklahoma, if Tulsa was under threat, I think people would react the same exact way, which is mass hysteria.
Yeah, I mean, if we're gonna measure the specific volume of pants failing that was going on, we can maybe do that. But if you're out there, give us a call. Tell us what's going on. 347-335-0818 in the few minutes we have left. And I just like to point out that, yes, I was aware of Pearl Harbor, and that was kind of the point I was making.
Yeah, so I thought that was being, yeah, exactly. It could have been missed, because you do have a subtle way of being sarcastic.
Well, I was doing a lot of winking and gesticulating, but then I realized that doesn't work on the radio so much. But
that's right, yeah.
Yeah,
you want to have a Sean Spicer moment right. There with regard to U.S. history this time.
But yeah, 347-335-0818. Tweet at us at Hacker Radio Show, and let us know. Let us know what else is going on.
There was a lot going on this particular week, I think, in these last couple of minutes. Maybe we should have like a sort of little update on this net neutrality nonsense.
Yeah. There's a story on Ars Technica. The FCC has all sorts of has all sorts of things going on. The U.S. Government Accountability Office will investigate the use of impersonation in public comments on the FCC's net neutrality repeal. You might remember the FCC reported all kinds of comments coming in support of taking down net neutrality. And a researcher at ShmooCon, the recent hacker conference that happened in the D.C. area, named Leah Figueroa, had presented some interesting findings. Apparently, a large amount of like thousands upon thousands of the emails that came in had were addresses at Pornhub.com, which of course is a popular site for grown-up movies, and the site themselves, they don't give their email addresses out to people in the larger internet, and they've only at last count had 55 employees. So either each employee sent out thousands of individual messages from their own work account to the FCC, or there's something funny going on here.
Yeah, for some reason, I think that the 55 employees at Pornhub are busy doing other things. And,
they've got
so concerned about net neutrality. But
I feel like they would be more concerned about it than anybody because if they use so much bandwidth.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Absolutely.
But they'd be on the other side. They'd be supporting or opposing the repeal.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, this would go against their interest, right? This would sort of be a very much a statement against their own interest. You're absolutely right. The other thing that came out of these couple of stories, which I thought was quite neat and seems to have been glossed over, but the way in which this massive amount of comments was posted to the FCC net neutrality comment board or system was that this system was designed, actually, it was a feature that allowed massive amounts of comments to be uploaded singly because they wanted to allow the names and addresses and signatures of people who had signed on to online petitions to upload their comments into this particular FCC commenting system. And it was that feature that was taken advantage of by these bots and imposters of U.S. citizens to make all of these anti-net neutrality comments. So they took this thing that was designed to give a voice, a very kind of egalitarian and democratic voice, to massive amounts of people who had signed online petitions, and used that kind of democratic interaction against us. And that, I think, is really quite an interesting wrinkle to this particular story that, I think this is going to have to be redesigned, and that kind of interaction with the FCC or any other governmental agency is going to be curtailed because of these quite likely few bad apples that had taken advantage of this system that allowed comments to be so easily manipulated.
And of course, it's academic anyway, since the FCC later announced that they really don't have to pay attention to comments that come in when they make their decisions.
Oh, of course. Or hold public hearings on those. Yeah, why bother?
Why in representative government do we want the people to have any kind of voice? The story about this on theregister.co.uk just ends, American democracy, ain't it great?
I know. Well, there you have it.
Absolutely. And on that note, we're just about out of time on this edition of Off the Hook. Send us your emails, oth@2600.com. Tweet at us at Hacker Radio Show, and keep in touch. Let us know what's going on out there, what piques your interest, what projects you're working on in the hacker and tech worlds. And we would love to hear about them. So for Off the Hook, for Emmanuel and Kyle, for everything that's going on in the world, this is Rob T. Firefly saying good night. Good night. You gotta keep them separated.
separated. Keep them separated. Separated.
Like the latest fashion, like a spread of disease. The kids trapped on the way to the classroom, getting whippy.
Gotta keep them separated.
They can't say, gotta roll, get this look out. They have to get this slapping and it's all of a foul. If one guy's gonna pay the others to me, they're gonna bash it up, bash it
gotta
up.
Gotta keep them separated.
Hey! A man, you're talking back to me. Drink them off.
Separated.
Hey! The man, you're disrespecting me. Take them off.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hey, hey, hey! Don't be on my. You're under 18, you won't be doing it. Die, 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 die.
Gotta keep them separated. Separated.
There was a song came on the radio, a guitar instrumental, and it changed everything.
Link Wray, it's rock and roll.
Rumble. Yeah, that's the one.
Rumble.
Hey, Rumble.
Rumble had the power to help me say, I'm going to be a musician.
And then I found out that he was an Indian.
The music that we know here in the United States is fully supported by input from Native and Indigenous people.
Sayago, this is John Cain from WBAI's Let's Talk. Join me on January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, as we kick off 2018 with a free screening of Rumble, the Indians who rocked the world.
Today is January the 24th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN-FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are slightly different. Based on the correspondence we receive, we find that there are many people listening to the show on demand or podcast than the regular program that is on the air on radio, so we will try to do something different. If you have a technical question or statement you want to make, send us a brief description of what you want to talk about along with your name, telephone number, and the day and time of the day we can call you, and we would then in turn play back telephone recordings of general interest for airing on the Personal Computer Show. In late breaking news as reported by the Wall Street Journal, Qualcomm was slapped with a $1.23 billion fine by the European Union for illegal payments to Apple. Well, Apple negotiated with Qualcomm back in 2011 that rebate payments be received for target goals in use of Qualcomm chips. To get the best possible deal, Apple agreed to use Qualcomm baseband chips exclusively. By the way, they were the only ones that had it available. European Union says that this is an abuse of its dominant position by paying billions of dollars to Apple for chips exclusively. The European Union hit Qualcomm with this $1.23 billion antitrust fine today for illegal payments it made to Apple for exclusively using its chip in smartphones and other products. The decision itself, however, has no repercussion for Apple because the accusations don't center around any cartel. Apple eventually started sourcing some of its chips from Intel in the fall of 2016 when it became available, and this was shortly before the contract with Qualcomm was due to expire. Qualcomm strongly disagrees with this decision and would appeal to the European Union's second highest court. However, the way it's structured in Europe, the company still must comply with EU's decision regardless of the appeal. The European Union last summer fined Google $2.42 billion for abusing its dominance in its shopping service, and in 2016, it ordered Apple to pay $13 billion in alleged unpaid taxes to Ireland. Ireland says they don't owe those money, but the European Union says, yes, you do. Well, these companies are all appealing these decisions. However, as I said before, they could appeal it, but they must still comply with the European Union's decision. But before we get to the feature articles, let's get to what has been news during the past week. A bug that can cripple the iPhone with a single text message has been discovered, and the so-called text bomb can crash or restart a device upon receiving a text message containing a link to malicious code, and the victim doesn't even have to click on it to be affected. The bug also slows Safari browsers used to surf the internet on Macs, and it does drain battery levels. The security researcher who found this has reported to Apple, but Apple themselves have not commented on the matter and when it will be addressed. While the bug could be incredibly irritating if abused, it does not present a security risk to customers. Originally, AMD processors weren't affected by the Meltdown CPU flaw, and it was attributed only to Intel. However, researchers have discovered the methodology was adopted also in AMD. Microsoft's new patch solved the problem where it originally, when it was applied to AMD processors, caused a boot-up problem. The patch is called KB4073290 for AMD processors. Microsoft says it will either deploy this via Windows Update or, for those with the AMD processor, it can manually download it and do the update. Microsoft had done some investigation that some AMD chipsets, which they have not identified by model number, do not conform to the documentation previously provided to Microsoft to develop the Windows operating system. To prevent AMD customers from getting into an unbootable state, Microsoft will temporarily pause sending the following Windows operating system updates to devices which impacts AMD processors at this time. Microsoft didn't specify which AMD CPUs are vulnerable to the error. If your AMD PC refuses to boot after installing last week's emergency patch, Microsoft says its guides for troubleshooting blue screen errors in Windows 7, 8, and 10 may help. Actually, I had given the procedure on how you can get through the fix pretty easily last week, so if you can refer back to last week's broadcast, we'll get you through it. Even if you can't install the Meltdown patch at this time, you should upgrade your web browser immediately. The web browsers in question is Firefox, Chrome, Internet Explorer, and Edge, has all been updated with initial protection against Spectre CPU exploit, a separate issue from Meltdown and these flawed Windows patches. AMD chips are susceptible to Spectre. Also, be sure to keep your security software vigilant while you're working with the Windows patch. It won't be able to detect if the Meltdown or Spectre exploits are in conflict with the security software that you're using. This, by the way, has driven home, and it should have driven home to everyone, to regularly back up your PC. This has been a mantra that we've been asking everyone to follow up, and I guess by repeating it week after week, by saying back up, back up, back up, it sounds like it's something that you've heard before. You need not go through it. Really, take it to heart. Back up your system. If your data's backed up, it won't be the end of the world if a Windows update or a nasty bit of malware really cripples your system. And if you haven't done your backup, there's very little we can do to help you recover. There are things that I would buy locally if I could buy it at all. Things like small electronic parts, a diode here or a transistor there. I used to be able to buy it at a local electronics store. Of course, they're no longer available. I used to go to Lafayette Radio, Arrow Electronics, go down to Cortland Street where all the electronics stores were. Okay, so I wound up paying a little more when only Radio Shack was making the items available. Now, even that's not available anymore. With great reluctance, anything that costs, you know, $2-3, you go mail order. And the mail order is like, the postage is $5, sometimes $10. And you say, there's got to be a different way of doing it. Well, I think that Amazon's finally figured out that items which are $10 and less, which are really small items, they're offering free shipping. That got my attention. Amazon has added a new $10 and under section to its app and website. And these items that cost $10 or cheaper will all have free shipping, whether or not you are a Prime membership. I give that a thumbs up. Mac computers running the latest version of Apple's High Sierra operating system have a flaw that just about let anyone unlock and edit a person's App Store preferences with any password. This vulnerability isn't as bad as the one that was found late November that allowed anyone to obtain higher administrative privileges on the Apple Mac computers merely by entering the username root, R-O-O-T, while logging into the user and group section of a Mac computer system preference menu. That earlier security hole has since been patched, of course, enabled anyone with physical access to a machine to view any files or change and reset any password for other users. The new flaw, uncovered and posted on the Open Radar site, it's a bug reporting website, is really indeed troubling. The finding so far is that it raises concern about Apple security design, given that this is a second trivial login bug to come to light in just a few months. Apple has to do a better job of quality checking patches. Fortune successfully tested the bypass on a 2012 MacBook Pro running the latest version of Mac OS High Sierra. After unlocking the App Store preferences, a person can tweak a certain password settings, such as the frequency with which a system asks for a user's password when approving app-related purchases. Even so, attackers cannot go on prolonged spending sprees. The two options are always require or require after 15 minutes. One big caveat, though, anyone looking to take advantage of this authentication has to be logged in as an administrator. When Fortune tested the approach on a 2015 MacBook Air using a non-administrative account, all attempts did fail. Apple appears to be testing a patch for a bug in an early version of a coming Mac OS High Sierra upgrade 10.3.3. Look forward to it. It's malware, although some people say, no, it's not malware. It's helpful extensions for your browser, such as what is installed into Chrome and Firefox. Wouldn't it be nice if these malware authors make it easy to remove that dirty code? Sometimes all you have to do is open the control panel and uninstall the offending program, just like any other application. And for browsers, simply nuke the extension that is causing the problem. Unfortunately, some of the recent browser extensions for Chrome and Firefox are making things very difficult to remove, and they are very clever in hiding their whereabouts. The extension in question hijacked Chrome and Firefox to redirect web searches and drive up click counts on YouTube videos, presumably to generate ad revenue. Well, that in itself is not unusual, but it is frustrating that you can't just load up extension pages and delete them. They do this by closing out pages with extensions and add-on information and they send information to users onto a different page altogether, such as an app overview pages where extensions do not appear. In Firefox, this problem is relatively easy to circumvent, but for Chrome, it takes a lot of digging, so much so that perhaps the fastest way to remove the problem is to report it to Chrome, and hopefully they can solve it for you. In my case, I don't use that many extensions, so I don't find it to be a problem at all. I just uninstall the entire browser. I make sure it's completely uninstalled. I go into the program area and make sure that the subdirectory, which houses all that what we call mouse trails, is also removed, and it's gone. I try very hard not to include any